Chief Justice, may it please the court.
I'm Giancarlo Conoparo.
I'm Zach Smith.
And welcome to SCOTUS 101, where we break down what's happening at the Supreme Court, what the justices are up to,
and other things related to our favorite branch of government.
It's a quiet week at the Supreme Court, so in this rehearing episode, we'll replay my interview with Justice Caleb Stegall. Justice Stegall, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here, Giancarlo.
So, Justice, what first sparked your interest in the law?
I really did not have an early interest in law like a lot of lawyers do from either early childhood or even high school. I grew up in a family that for a very long time, going back many generations, were pastors. So I was a pastor's kid. I actually didn't know any lawyers growing up. But I did always love language and words. And I was attracted early on to arguments and questions about public policy and politics. I spent actually my first post-college years as a high school teacher, but I suppose those interests naturally led and eventually led to law school.
Was the decision to go to law school organic? Did it flow out of any particular event?
Yeah, I had a very good friend from my undergrad years who went to law school a few years before I did, and he began talking to me about it and essentially said, look, this is for you. You got to do this. And my wife, Ann, and I had two young kids at the time, and I was sort of casting about. I always loved teaching, but I kind of knew it wasn't going to be a long-term career option. On a sort of a lark, I took the LSAT and did well enough on it to think that, yeah, this should be something I pursue.
Hmm. And how did you find law school?
I loved law school. I was never a great student prior to law school. I think that the sort of highly competitive nature of the classes, the subject matter certainly, but also I really thrived in an environment where it was, at least when I went, it was still the old school method of all or nothing, one test at the end. And that really fit my personality and the kind of environment that led to me doing well. So I really loved law school.
After law school, you clerked for Judge Dinel Tacha on the 10th Circuit. What was that experience like?
Yeah, forgive me for correcting the pronunciation, but she pronounces it Taha.
My mistake.
And I was very fortunate to clerk for Judge Taha. It was a wonderful and unique experience for a young lawyer. Obviously, that's a common thing that those of us in the ranks of federal appellate clerks say, which is truly a testament to our judiciary and to that system of clerkships, which provides great mentoring opportunities for young lawyers. She was a great judge. Probably more importantly, she was one of the kindest and really most supportive mentors that I've ever had. So it was a tremendous experience, and I count myself very fortunate to have gotten to do that.
Do you have any favorite memories of her or the work you did for her?
So I would say that probably it's just the day-to-day work of learning and being intimately involved in what an appellate judge does. We got to wrestle through, of course, the very knotty legal problems that would be presented in the cases. Yet you develop very close relationships with co-clerks and certainly with our judge. Judge Taha was immensely open in her receptivity to our ideas. She would hear them through, even if at the end of the day, one of her favorite sayings was, I'm Article 3, you're not. So that was her way of saying, my opinion counts more than yours. But it was always a collaborative process, which was tremendous. I remember traveling to Denver, where the 10th Circuit sits, for arguments several times during that year, and that was a real thrill. I think that it's a common experience for young people once you've achieve something small, but you're at the beginning of your career and you realize you're on the inside of something that seems very important. And that kind of experience is of course very memorable. So, and I would just add that during my clerkship year, Judge Taha became the chief judge of the 10th Circuit. So probably my favorite memory of the whole year was during the weekend of her investiture, because Justice Breyer, who was the supervising justice of the 10th, came for the ceremony, and us Taha clerks got to take him to the local bar afterwards. And he was very generous to give us several hours of just unvarnished conversation over beers in our local towny bar. So that was certainly a standout memory for me.
Sounds like it. So after your clerkship, you remained in Kansas, Topeka, where you're from, and practiced law as an associate at Fulston and Sifkin. What sort of work did you do there?
Yeah, so I'm from Lawrence, which is just about 30 miles east of Topeka, which is the home of the University of Kansas. And I both myself and my wife, Ann, were very committed to staying in Kansas. Like I said, we had young kids. Fulston's the largest law firm in Kansas, but its primary offices are in Wichita. So at that time, it had a satellite office in Topeka, and they had just begun to develop a bit of a government relations practice, which was supplemented by some general litigation practice. So I kind of had the best of both worlds. I was part of a large law firm, but in a small satellite office. I got to do a lot of different things right away. Really enjoyed being in the state capital of Topeka and thinking through what does a government relations practice look like. And I met a few mentors there who taught me a great deal.
Hmm. You eventually left to start your own firm outside of Topeka in Perry. What made you decide to do that?
Yeah, that's a bit of a long story, probably. I can probably do my best to give you a simple version of it. I think I would have to take into account probably two factors. The first was that at this point in time, and this was about 2004, I had been reading pretty deeply in the agrarian literary tradition of our region, and I was enamored in particular with a fictional character named Wheeler Catlett in the work of Wendell Berry. And Wheeler Catlett was a country lawyer who, and there is some romanticization of this ideal of the country lawyer who hangs a shingle on Main Street. But I had always resisted this professional pressure to specialize, and I really wanted to embrace that vision of a lawyer as a Main Street generalist, someone who anyone in the community could, you know, pop in over the lunch hour and say, hey, I have a problem. Can you help me with it? And I was really actually very curious to know whether such a thing was even still possible or feasible in the 21st century. So the second factor was at work, which was at work simultaneously, was really political. The early 2000s, of course, were this, it was still the Wild West days of writing on the internet. It was the golden era of blogs and you know, web signs and so on before social media took over. And along with a couple of friends, I had started and edited an online publication that by 2004, it had gained actually quite a bit of national attention. We had been profiled on the front page of the New York Times and so on. And that, all of that was a very heady experience for this rather sheltered and poor pastor's kid from Kansas. So one side effect of that was that it actually opened a number of professional doors for me back home of the political variety. And so I began to pick up political clients and was asked to do a lot of the kind of work that a white shoe firm like Fulston would traditionally turn down because it was too controversial and would probably upset some client, right? If you have a very wide client base, you have to be careful about those things. So that generated some tension. And really the final break came in 2004 when I was asked by the Republican Party to run for a vacant seat in the Kansas Senate. And I really wanted to do that, and Fulston said no. So I passed on the opportunity, but I did immediately sort of say, okay, I need to leave, not because I dislike the firm, but I think our interests were diverging at that point. And looking back, I am glad that it worked out that way. Things would have been very different if I had run for that spot. And I still have a lot of great friendships with people at Fulston. So I have nothing but gratitude for what it did for me. But the upshot is by early 2005, I was a solo practitioner on the main street of my adopted hometown of Perry, which had a population of 900 people.
So did it work out? Is it possible?
It is possible, although, you know, there's some nuance there. It did work out. It worked out tremendously. Those years in what I called the Stegall Law Firm were really the most fun I ever had practicing law. The Stegall Law Firm ended up with about a six-year run, 2005 to 2010. I had four full-time lawyers by the time we were done, which actually I think made Perry, Kansas, the lawyer capital of Kansas, at least if you measure on a per capita basis, right? So we did a lot of political work, a lot of complex litigation at both the trial and appellate courts. And of course, that's not local work. So my romantic ideal of being a local Main Street guy did come to fruition, but economically it was very much supplemented by my statewide and even regional work. I think I kind of had a reputation at that point as the guy who, if he believed in your case, he would take a lot of cases other lawyers didn't want. I don't know that that's something I'd recommend to other young lawyers, because there's usually good reasons why a case shouldn't be taken if the rest of the bar won't touch it. But at least in my case, it did expose me to some really amazing opportunities very early on in a young career. And I think I had a lot of good luck. I had some blessings of providence and maybe a little good lawyering thrown in there. We won a lot of those cases. And really, there's nothing like the feeling of winning as the underdog, right? I think a lot of people have experienced that. That's a great feeling.
Could you tell us about maybe one of those cases of which you're most proud?
Sure. So I have a lot of great stories from that time, as you can imagine. Can I actually pick two to share with you? I
think by all means.
Pretty illustrative of the time there. First, from 2002 to 2006, Kansas had a very polarizing attorney general named Phil Klein. And he had a very aggressive and sort of in-your-face style. He was a bit of a Trumpist long before Trumpism was a thing. He had been pursuing some legal actions against abortion providers in the state during his tenure. And, of course, he amassed a long list of prominent enemies very quickly. And he was defeated rather decisively in 2006 by a man who had been the Johnson County District Attorney. And that's the big suburb of Kansas City. And that person had actually switched parties specifically to run against Klein. And because of that oddity, it was a bit of a Shakespearean twist. The Republican Party in Kansas City then appointed Attorney General Klein to complete the unfinished term of the Kansas City District Attorney. So the two rivals switched places, and the new Attorney General promptly sued the ex-Attorney General in an effort to stop him from pursuing these legal actions. And I had never actually met Klein, but in early 2007, when this was happening, I got a call from him, and he said, essentially, I think I need a lawyer, and I was told I should call you. So I ended up taking that fight lasted several years. It was incredibly contentious and controversial. It really was actually very politically toxic for almost everyone involved. And I'm very grateful that I managed to come through relatively unscathed, but it was a battle of sort of high drama, high stakes, which was a great experience for me. And then just briefly, the representation I'm most proud of, which I think was your question, was a tremendously unique experience I had when I was asked to represent a number of American missionaries who had traveled to Haiti following a devastating earthquake that occurred there in 2010, I think it was, January 2010. And those folks had answered the call. They wanted to go help in the midst of destruction and, of course, chaos and suffering. And their hope had been to work with several orphanages to rescue children who had lost their families. Their zeal really overtook their good planning, however, and they attempted to move a bus full of kids across the border into the Dominican Republic. And they were arrested, they were charged with kidnapping and child trafficking, and the case really became an international sensation, with media from literally across the globe having an intense interest in it. One of them happened to be from Kansas, which was how I ended up being their lawyer. And the full story of that case, really, we could do an entire podcast just on that. But it led to some truly remarkable episodes of legal maneuvering, and the short end of the story was we were eventually able to win their release and convince the Haitian government to drop the charges against them and then to safely bring them back home, working with the United States State Department.
Wow. So you mentioned that your representation of Klein was very contentious, and some of your representations, especially that one, were used against you in your confirmation hearings on the theory that because you represented people who were seen as bad or holding unpopular views, that reflected poorly on you as their lawyer. Now, you've rejected that theory and have defended other lawyers, notably now Judge Carl Folsom, from that same criticism. Can you tell us about your thinking on that?
Yeah, I do think this is a tremendously important issue for the judiciary, but even beyond the judiciary, for society. A little bit of background context. I was nominated to the Kansas Court of Appeals, which was my first judicial posting. I happened to have been the first nominee that went through a new process in Kansas, which mirrors the federal process. So there were Senate confirmation hearings and so on. And the fact that it was the first one ever and that had been adopted by the administration, which I had been working for, really put me under a unique spotlight of scrutiny and attention at that point in time. There was also a lot of partisan opposition. So in that context, a lot of my prior writings and certainly my representation of former Attorney General Klein were featured front and center by those who thought that I should not be a judge. But really, to their great credit, I would say there were a number of really prominent Kansas attorneys who were known to be maybe on the left or at least known to not share my political views. And they stepped forward and very publicly said that that kind of criticism was out of bounds because, of course, in our system, every person, even and especially those who are not popular, deserves and needs competent legal representation so that our system can function the way it should. So a number of years later, when the situation was reversed and our Democrat Governor Laura Kelly had appointed a public defender, you referenced him, now Judge Carl Folsom, who had a stellar record as a public defender, a number of conservative members of our state Senate chose to attack him and fault him for representing some of society's most despised criminals. And I just felt at that point in time, it was important for me to speak up, having had the unique position that I did. And I did so, I think, primarily through op-eds that were published across the state. And I would like to think that there was some that had some effectiveness just in terms of reminding our public officials and our state as a whole what it is that lawyers do and why even those who are most despised need representation.
So this was all done, or your representation of Klein was done while you were at the Stegall Law Firm, but it was not the only job you had at that time. You had a second, or you were the county attorney for Jefferson County. How did you manage two jobs? What did you do as county attorney?
Yeah, it's not actually that unusual in Kansas. In smaller jurisdictions in Kansas, and I think this is similar to a number of other states, we have county attorneys as opposed to district attorneys, but the job duties and responsibilities are essentially the same. The primary difference between the larger and smaller jurisdictions is that the county attorney positions are generally considered to be part-time. So actually, there are quite a few privately practicing attorneys in Kansas who also hold that public office of county attorney, and they oversee the prosecutor's office in the jurisdiction. And so, just like a lot of my opportunities that have come along, it sort of landed in my lap when I was asked to take on that role. And fortunately, I was chosen by my fellow citizens and really enjoyed my time as county attorney, got to learn all about prosecution. You really run that whole office. We handled everything from traffic tickets to a few first-degree murder prosecutions.
Wow. So eventually you left the county attorney's office and the Stegall Law Firm to become chief counsel to Governor Sam Brownback. What led to that change and what did you do in that position?
Yeah, and so this was around 2010. Then Senator Sam Brownback had made a term limit pledge. And so he, in keeping with his term limit pledge, was leaving the United States Senate and had come back to Kansas to run for governor. And he really won fairly easily in that election, November 2010. And a month later, in December, I got a call from his chief of staff. And he asked me, or really it was more than ask, he sort of told me, we need you to be the chief counsel in the new Brownback administration. And that was probably the hardest decision I've ever had to make in terms of my career. I really did give up a thriving practice that I loved at the Stegall Law Firm. And I still have a twinge of sadness when I think about kind of leaving it right when it was really going gangbusters. But I sort of had to follow a path that I'd trod for myself previously, which was to be really as open as possible to whatever opportunities sort of providentially are laid in front of me and to do so as faithfully as I could. So I accepted the position, and it did turn out to be yet another very interesting ride. It might be easier to answer the second part of your question about what I did by saying what I didn't do as chief counsel, because I did get to be very intimately involved, really, with the entire operation of the administration. This is, of course, if you can think back or listeners can think back, this was right at the onset of the Tea Party era. There was this very heady sense in the air, very sort of electric buzz that big conservative reforms were coming. And Sam, Governor Brownback, was actually one of the leading figures in that. And he set the tone with a very aggressive, big and bold package of reform proposals that pretty much touched every area of state government. So to be part of the small team that was really tasked with making that happen was a tremendous experience.
Now, how did it come about that he ended up nominating you to the Court of Appeals and then to the state Supreme Court?
Yeah, one of the big, like I mentioned, he had a large reform package that covered all sorts of policy areas. But one of them was his desire to reform the method of selection, which Kansas uses to choose our judges. And we use what's commonly referred to as the Missouri Plan. It's considered to be a nonpartisan merit-based system wherein there's a nominating commission made up of lawyers and laypersons who interview applicants and then forward three names onto the governor for appointment. And once the governor picks a nominee, that person is then fully vested with the office. There's no role for the legislature or for the Senate to do confirmations. And the governor also is restricted by the nominating commission. So that's the Missouri plan in short. And Governor Brownback believed, along with many others in our state, that that was not democratic. It was a bit too closed room, you know, the in crowd picking their folks, and the people of Kansas through their elected representatives did not have enough of a say. So there was a lot of effort to introduce various reform proposals. He was successful he was able to get through a reform for the Kansas Court of Appeals, which is our intermediate appellate court, but failed at the Supreme Court. So Kansas actually still has this bifurcated system where for the Court of Appeals, we follow more or less the federal model, which is the governor appoints whomever they choose with Senate confirmation. And at the Supreme Court, we still have the Missouri plan. So soon after that reform was adopted, this was the legislative session of 2013, there was a vacancy on the Court of Appeals, and Sam looked at me and said, you're going to be the first guy up there. And to be fair, I had wanted to do that as well. So, and very quickly after that, there was a vacancy on the Supreme Court, which I applied for and went through the nominating commission process. So within the space of 1 year, I got to experience both systems very up close and personal. And I'm still the only Kansas judge to have done that, I think. And that does give me a unique perspective on this whole debate about judicial appointments.
So how would you characterize your judicial philosophy?
Well, there's a lot. Of course, there's a lot of ways to answer that question, right? I'm going to guess that your listeners are probably familiar with the nomenclature here. So I think the simplest and most direct way to answer that is just to acknowledge right up front that I am very much a self-declared originalist in my judicial philosophy. Like so many of my generation who sort of matured in the law in the 90s, and I did so under the writings and influence of Justice Scalia. And in particular, his emphasis, I would say, on constitutional structure over and against constitutional rights. And so at least when doing constitutional adjudication, I certainly continue to believe, as Scalia taught, that a judge's primary responsibility is both to the original public meaning of the words in the document, but with a particular attention to maintaining this carefully crafted balance that exists within our constitutional structure. So I've written actually in opinions that it's not the role of judges to adjudicate values, but rather to police boundaries. So that metaphor has been important for me. I've written that, in fact, constitutional boundaries, if you must talk in terms of constitutional values, the only values declared by the Constitution are the boundaries it sets forward. So that's the starting place. I do think as I've grown as a judge, and grown is a dangerous word to use, right, in the context of sitting on the bench, it has a lot of bad connotations, certainly. But I think those bad connotations can be redeemed by an honest assessment that hopefully we get better at what we do. We learn, we grow, we mature. And I certainly don't think that that's a bad thing necessarily. And I would say that over the course of my years on the bench, I've come to see that originalism is necessary, but it's not sufficient. There's always going to be a plus after originalism. And I think this is this is understood by people at a very gut level. They know that judges are people too, and that originalism by itself is not enough to decide some of the most contentious cases. So to be honest, it's important to ask, well, what is that plus? What does that mean? And I find that to be the most fascinating, actually, discussion and argument happening within the realm of the legal academy and those who debate judicial philosophy right now. And of course, it's a very active discussion, even on the conservative side of things. I think it's particularly interesting to navigate these things as a sitting judge on a court of constitutional last resort. I recently wrote a law review essay trying to explore some of this, and I just wanted to push back ever so gently on this notion that's prominent in conservative judicial circles that judges, you know, a good judge is never, quote unquote, result oriented. They just apply the law. And I think that while carrying a really important kernel of truth, is not the whole picture, because even conservative judges need to understand what is the proper orientation of justice and of judging.
Could you give us a sense of a little bit of the argument you make in that essay?
Yes, it's a complex argument, which I would not be doing it justice to try to summarize it in a few short sentences. But essentially, the conclusion of the essay is that a society that is living at peace with itself, essentially, is a worthwhile ends towards which judges must be oriented. So I would certainly, you know, to the extent there's any interest, I would refer folks to the actual essay. I tried to develop a somewhat lengthy and complex argument for that.
What's the name of it, and where is it published?
It's published in the Kansas Law Review, and it's called The Ethics of Decision Making.
All right, fascinating. Well, I'll put a link to that in the description of the episode.
Thank you for that.
So let me shift gears for a moment. As a Kansas Supreme Court justice, do you have law clerks?
I do. I'm very privileged to have two law clerks right now. And I probably had over 10 law clerks during my tenure as a justice. But then the two I have right now are tremendous young lawyers. I certainly couldn't do without them. I tell them that their job is to make sure I don't screw up too badly, and that also there will be there'll be a possibility every day for them to fail in that mission. so far, I think so good. And so they're doing a tremendous job. But joking aside, I think that working in, again, it harkens back to my time as a clerk, being able to be part of what really is a miniature law firm and work collaboratively to fight your way through some of the most difficult legal questions that we can be presented with is a thrilling thing, and it never gets old. So that's our little law firm in the Kansas Supreme Court courthouse.
So early on in the episode, you mentioned that you had started off as a teacher, that you really loved teaching, and you, as a justice, did teach for a while at the Kansas University Law School, but you resigned from that position in the wake of a free speech controversy on campus. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that happened fairly recently. This was at the end of last year. It was a pretty difficult and I would say painful episode for me. If you know anything about me, or, you know, it's fairly easy to tell for anyone who reads my writings that I love Kansas. I love everything about Kansas. And that includes our flagship university, the University of Kansas. And I've always been a Jayhawk, always will be a Jayhawk. I have tremendous respect for the law school. I'm an alum of the law school. Have known the folks there for a very long time. And I can't talk too much about the specifics of what happened there. I made some promises not to do that publicly. But I do think I can say in short that the law school ended up handling a free speech issue in a way that drew lines, which frankly, from my perspective, were unacceptable, and I simply could not countenance them as a faculty member. And that's a difficult thing. I know people are in those circumstances probably on a daily basis these days. And those are hard calls to make. Beyond that, you know, I did have a letter of resignation that ended up in the hands of the media. And I guess I would say that it speaks for itself, if that's acceptable to you.
Fair. So in that letter of resignation, you wrote the following, that there's a perennial temptation to cheat on the social contract, to shortcut or bypass the liberal public square on the road to achieving one's preferred outcomes. And you went on to say such efforts are drawn to censorship, reprisal against one's – sorry, let me take that again. You went on to write that such efforts are drawn to censorship, reprisals against those espousing disfavored views, and to dividing people based on shared group identities and characteristics. From my perspective, this seems to be a fairly common phenomenon on campuses at the moment. Why do you think that sort of thing is happening, and how do we resist that temptation going forward?
Well, I agree with you. I think it is an all too common phenomena. And I guess I'm pleased that you recognize in what I wrote something that sounds familiar to you. I think that is at least an indication that I was over the target, as they say. You know, I think it's also important to say right up front that none of our many-sided right partisan divides, none of them have cornered the market on this, which is to say that this is a problem that crosses all partisan divisions. And I think it's a tendency that we seem to have developed to really, as I said, to want to bypass or skip the civic duty of engaging in the deliberative process. We want to go straight to the quote unquote winning, right? We just want to win. We would prefer to skip the hard work that really precedes what I would characterize as a true and appropriate kind of a win, which is when you win hearts and minds. And I think skipping that deliberative process is incredibly dangerous. I think we're seeing that play itself out. And really, a key insight here, which heightens the danger level of this kind of behavior, is that there's no legal fix. And that's not to say that all the litigation over free speech and the First Amendment aren't important. Of course they are. But at the end of the day, this is an extra legal problem, or maybe it would be more proper to call it a pre-legal problem, which to me, it's why it's helpful to frame it in terms of the social contract. There's really no constitution in the world. There's no judiciary in the world. No amount of originalism or what have you can fix a broken social contract. That really requires something pre-legal. It requires a renewal of, I guess, what I would describe as the habits or practices or norms that make up what we might call and what many of our founders called Republican virtue. And I think for those of us who see this as a real crisis, especially those of us in positions of authority, we have a duty, a need to articulate and defend and really exhort our fellow citizens towards a renewal of that, towards a renewal of Republican virtue. And I think there's a common misunderstanding that can go along with that. So to be clear, from my perspective, and I think historically speaking, this is not a call for kumbaya and a group hug. That's not what this is. As I can attest, and we've already talked about some of this, practicing Republican virtue really will put you right in the middle of some of the most contentious and difficult battles, because it requires participating. And in generating this deliberative sense, you are a participant in what you hope will end up being a consensus, or at a minimum, a result generated by the political community. And that's what our constitutional structure is aiming at. I think it's in our day and age, there's this particular form of what I would call impatience and laziness to want to opt out of that more difficult path. That's why I think it's effective to refer to it as cheating on the social contract, because it's a shortcut, and it's really a shortcut to political disintegration, in my view.
Fair. Well, Justice, this has been fascinating. I want to thank you for the time you spent with us and ask you our final question before you go. If you could have a conversation with any Supreme Court justice, living or dead, who would it be and what would you talk about?
Okay, that's an easy one for me. I love the question. I've mentioned already my time with Justice Breyer. I've also had the pleasure of several long dinners with some of the other sitting justices. And of course, those are all wonderful and memorable. But this is an easy one for me, because if I could have any pick, I would spend the day in the Kansas countryside with my fellow Kansan and my historical colleague on the Kansas Supreme Court, David Brewer. And David Brewer was a member of the Kansas Supreme Court in the late 19th century. And after serving on the Kansas Supreme Court, he served as a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court from 1890 to, I think, about 1910. So my guess is we would probably talk about all things Kansas and mostly ignore that faraway court.
Well, Justice, thank you again for joining us. It's been my pleasure.
Well, you're welcome. It has been a delight for me as well, and I really appreciate it. So thank you.
Case is submitted.
You've been listening to SCOTUS 101, brought to you by more than 500,000 members of the Heritage Foundation. Executive produced by Giancarlo Canaparo and Zach Smith. Sound designed by Lauren Evans, Mark Guiney, and John Popp. For more information, visit heritage.org.